from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With little fanfare this morning, AOL Time Warner quietly dropped the AOL from the company's name and logo. The name change marks a symbolic end to a decade of high-flying internet dreams when new media upstart AOL engulfed old media giant Time Warner in a stunning $183 billion merger. Our guest tonight, Wall Street Journal technology columnist and longtime AOL watcher Kara Swisher, prophetically described the ill-fated marriage as a company without assets buying a company without a clue. Bad blood and $100 billion in lost value ensued. The saga says volumes about the great boom and bust, about the real change and illusions that gushed out of the 1990s. Tonight on Point, the hard lessons in the spectacularly rocky AOL Time Warner merger. Do you remember that giddy day when Steve Case and Jerry Levin and Ted Turner whooped it up at the merger announcement? Are you surprised that AOL is off the nameplate? And what was that Kool-Aid everybody was drinking? Have you sworn off or not? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Kara Swisher, technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She covered AOL since 1994, first for The Washington Post and then for The Journal. She broke the story in August of AOL Time Warner dropping AOL from the company name and logo. Her new book is There Must Be a Pony in Here Somewhere, The AOL Time Warner Debacle and the Quest for the Digital Future. Good evening and welcome, Kara Swisher.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's great to have you. Terrific book. Really enjoyed it. Great read. Also
Thanks.
With me in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Nancy Kane, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Great to have you with us, Nancy.
Great to be here.
Kara Swisher, wow, what a position you're in. All through that great big 90s bubble, there you were.
Had a good time.
Oh, did you ever? Everybody read you. Everybody wanted a good word in Kara Swisher's column. You were one of those make-or-break venues for so many companies.
I'm not so sure about that.
Well, I think you probably were. I just wonder if you – there's so much in this saga, so much to look back on, so much to learn here. But just take us to the significance of what's happened today. Three letters taken out of the name off of this great big company.
Right.
In a nutshell, what does that signify? That those three letters AOL coming down.
Well, it's both one thing. It's highly symbolic and yet largely cosmetic. It makes everyone feel better at the company, obviously, and it makes Wall Street feel a little better. But, you know, the stock didn't do much. Nothing much happened. And really, they could call the company anything they want. I suggested to the Time Warner people they should call it Phyllis Diller, Inc. or whatever. It really doesn't matter what they call it. But it's sort of a symbol of within three short years, this thing has fallen apart to such an extent that they're actually changing the name back.
And, of course, the irony is that it's AOL that's coming down because that was the party on the warpath that came in here
Absolutely.
And essentially took over whatever Time Warner thought was happening, as you write. It was very clear in the minds of AOL executives that this baby was theirs.
Well, they got 56% of the company. You know, and interestingly, all the AOL executives that were involved in it are all gone now, and they've been gone for many months now. They had 56% of the company, so they should have that in their mind when it happened, because they did have the controlling interest.
When you think back to the day, what was it,
January 10th, 2000. Peak of the bubble.
Peak of the bubble. You had been covering AOL for half a dozen years at that point.
Right.
There you were. The whole gang was in Midtown Manhattan. As you describe it, euphoric executives lined up
yes.
to announce this transforming transaction. Do you remember watching that on that day? We all saw it emblazoned mm-hmm. across newspapers. And,
yep.
And,
I was shocked. We actually found out about it the night before, which I describe in the beginning of the book. And I had written a column 2 weeks before talking about how huge the valuation of AOL was, and there were all these rumors of things they would buy. And so I just threw out Time Warner as the name. Oh, you know, why don't they buy Time Warner? And
like that'll ever happen.
Yeah, and my editor made me took it out because she said I'd look stupid. And, you know, at that point she said, well, they might as well talk about buying France. And and so I took off the name. I actually took out the actual name of Time Warner. I said mm-hmm. a large media company. And so I was pretty shocked when we found out about it the night before the merger, which we reported on the Journal's online site.
Well, all the more shocked because you had seen
AOL when it was...
As losers.
As losers. When Steve Case was just this, what do you call him, business boy?
With big
dreams and no idea.
Big dreams, no ideas. You know, every aspect of AOL's history, I had written a book previously about the rise of AOL, actually called AOL.com, which is sort of the sequel. And they had gone from nothing to nothing constantly, and that's why I actually have the title of the book the way I do, because I don't know if you know the joke that Ronald Reagan actually popularized about a boy digging in a pile of manure, and someone asks him what he's doing, and he says, there must be a pony in here somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that was AOL's corporate mantra for so long, because they were always digging in a pile of manure and never finding anything. And so when they got
Time
Warner...
Like so much of the internet, but...
Right, exactly. But they did very well financially, but mm-hmm. they really... But I'm talking about before that, AOL sort of was there for so long, and they had so many disasters. I mean, if you remember the dial-up problem they had, getting people dialed in.
And many people many people don't realize, but it really goes back all the way to...
The mid-80s. Mm-hmm. They hardly held on until the boom happened. AOL was considered and also ran, and... One really prominent technology writer called them Dead Men Walking, America on Hold, all these. They were much maligned until the boom started. And then, of course, they got incredibly powerful in that time. But that was their corporate mantra. There must be a pony in here somewhere. And so presumably Time Warner was the pony, finally. This was it. And, of course, it turned out to be the pile of manure again.
So, Kara Swisher, on that day, January 10th, 2000, mm-hmm. AOL, Time Warner, what did it mean then? And today, looking back from the vantage of three, going on 4 years now, what does it mean now?
Well, you know, when I set out to do the book, I actually was thinking, I wanted to think about, was this a good idea that just went bad because of the deal and the people and the economy and all sorts of things? Or was it just a bad idea in the first place? And that was what I was sort of the quest I was on, because despite this disaster, I'm a huge believer in the internet and it's transformative. I hate to use that word because it's so sullied now. But I'm really a believer in what the internet's been doing for our society and business and everything else. And so I was hugely disappointed by what happened. Although at the time, I remember thinking, if Steve Case is getting out, I was thinking the stock market had to go down then, the internet stock market, because he had always been very smart about top-ticking things. And clearly, he made the deal of a century.
And you saw it even then as getting out? I mean, that's, of course, not the way it was presented. It was presented as synergy, as taking
right.
this forward to the internet century. This will be the biggest thing
ever. It was extremely
ever.
Exciting. I found it extremely exciting, the idea of it. But I remember in the book, I actually described, I called Jerry Yang, who owned Yahoo. I mean, is the founder of Yahoo. He doesn't own all of it. And I called him that night, right after the Sunday night, because I figured he'd know about it, because somehow he would have been knowledgeable about what was going on in deal making. And I called him after he put it on the Wall Street Journal website, and I said, I actually said, they're taking Weimar Republic money. What are you going to do?
That is the inflated AOL stock.
Right. Because his stock at that point was hugely, I think it was $200 a share for Yahoo.
Yeah.
Which made nothing, did nothing. It was worth Disney and Viacom combined or some incredible thing.
And France and Belgium thrown in.
Right. Maybe. You know, a small European country. And I was wondering what he was going to do, because clearly Steve Case had convinced someone that this internet stock was really worth trading real assets like Bugs Bunny and Sports Illustrated and CNN. So I thought Jerry's company was in a position to do the same thing with a Disney or a Viacom or something like that. So I wanted to see what would happen next, and obviously nothing did, but it was a really heady moment for everybody.
It was a heady moment. Nancy Kane, jump in here with us. You've looked at the history of American business over many, many years. I mean, this was one of the highest of the high points in terms of, what do you call it, the psychodrama, the anticipation, the wound-up expectations. How do you characterize that moment, January 2000, when AOL and Time Warner came together with AOL on top?
Well, it was a denouement in some sense of a great drama that's played itself out in a number of different moments in the American economy, in which there certain circumstances have to be in place on the stage, lighting, like a buoyant capital market that allows you to play games with Weimar Republic.
Super buoyant in this case.
Super buoyant. A regulatory environment that, in the case of media companies, was really favorably disposed toward this great technological change, which Kara writes about so articulately in her book. You know, the scene has to be set, but then you need major actors, dramatis personae, Stephen Case, Gerald Levin. If we go back to the 19th century, J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, John mm-hmm. Rockefeller, people that have an interest either through the capital markets or the product markets in putting things together for profit. All those circumstances coalesced in January of 2000, and it really was a denouement, an inflection point, because the slope of the curve, so to speak, both in terms of merger activity and in terms of the value of those mergers, was about to fall fairly precipitously, although no one could see it at the time, as indeed it has at other moments.
Kara Swisher, give us a sense in AOL Time Warner's case of just how precipitously things fell after that that ecstatic day.
Not as quickly as people think, because you have to understand what happened before it, which was it went on for years. This bubble was not a short bubble. It was a long bubble. And I think Gerald Levin got incredibly like, when's it going to stop? It's not stopping. And
well, used to it. It was as though it was the new reality, the new economy.
$40. Mm-hmm. You know, every day the stock would go up $40 a share, which is insane, and at the same time it wouldn't stop. And so you felt like an idiot for not being in on it. Mm. And I think afterwards, the real problem started to come when there was a huge IPO activity during 2000. It did not stop after that merger. And in April of 2000, 3 months after the merger, there was a correction. And a lot of the companies like Pets.com had a problem. It started to get ridiculous because all these companies were coming into the IPO market. So not what's before baked? I mean, it was like raw. What's before raw? I mean, there were at one point an investment banker came
sourdough
up to me and
said, "Sourdough starter."
I don't know what it was. Yeast.
Right.
What's before yeast? One investment banker at a very prominent firm came up to me and said, "You know, I want you to write about this company. It's pre-revenue." And I said, "That's enough. I've had it. I mean, no revenue, pre-revenue. I love that word. It was my favorite expression. I think I wrote about it in the book. But it started to soften up in April, but it didn't show because AOL was at the top of the food chain and the beneficiary of all this dot-com venture cash. And so Yahoo didn't start to show distress until the fall. And I think I wrote a story saying these stocks are really going to go down, and Yahoo's the first one. Because they've lived in this paradise of constantly having money thrown at them, and now it's getting to be desert conditions. Or can they survive? I doubt it. You know, I mean, can their stock survive?
Yeah.
And they started to fall off in December. So that was a full year after the merger was announced.
Mm-hmm.
AOL didn't really start to show huge weakness until the spring and summer of the following year, and by that time the merger was approved. So
and yet you call that merger a kind of internet Rubicon that stopped the boom in a boom that needed stopping. Kara Swisher, take us inside to the extent that you can. You've talked a lot with them, the heads of some of the principals here, the personalities and the perspective in January 2000. Who was Stephen Case on that day? Who was Gerald Levin on that day? What was going on in their minds?
Let me start with Steve Case. I mean, he had beat the odds all the time with AOL. That company was constantly on the edge of a precipice, constantly. I mean, it was sort of like it was funny. It was the perils of Pauline for that company. And then suddenly, after they started getting all these gushes of dot-com money, most of which either went to AOL or Yahoo. You know, if you were a dot-com company and you wanted to go public, you had to have an AOL deal.
Right.
It was ridiculous. To do an IPO, you needed that press release.
Stamp your
just
passport.
The press release.
Yep.
Exactly. So AOL was the beneficiary of tens of millions of dollars in that fashion.
People paying to get an AOL deal that would let them go public.
Public, exactly. Mm. And it totally worked. And AOL sometimes owned stock in those companies. The whole thing, the ethical implications.
So talk about riding the boom.
He's riding the boom, and all of a sudden, he's got the stock that continues to go up and up and doesn't see any sign of stopping. And he knew that it was ridiculous because I have an email memo that he's writing talking about what they should do, and he was marveling at eBay's $12 billion valuation. He's like, what the heck is that? That's ridiculous, you know. So he knew that they had to do something with this money, and they were all getting very panicked that at some point it was going to blow up and that they would not take advantage of the situation, which then they had a task force. They'd talk to AT&T. They thought an internet thing where they were going to buy eBay and Amazon and Intuit, which would have been the much better strategy.
But
now.
He knew. He felt it quaking.
He
wanted some real assets with this funny money.
And he was really interested in two things, content, which Time Warner has in abundance, and cable, which Time Warner has in abundance. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to get to that and to own the cable because he understood that broadband was where everything was coming. And they were in a largely dial-up business, which had gotten them that far, and they did a great job at attracting customers.
So if he knew all that, and we've just got a few seconds before the break, but does that mean that Gerald Levin was a fool? If Steve Case knew all that and he wanted the assets on funny money, how could the other party be sensible at the table?
Well, some people call him a dupe, but I call him a person. If he was conned, he was in on the con while he was being conned. He knew what was happening, and he had other reasons, which I'll talk about when you get
there. A con, in on the con, while he was being conned. That sounds like some
he
kind
knew.
Of
it was
Zen
a con,
conundrum.
It was a con
we've got to come
knew.
Back and sort that one out. Kara Swisher,
Nancy
Kane, stand by. We're talking tonight about the sad tale and saga of the AOL Time Warner dream. AOL is off the nameplate today. And there's a mountain of internet history in the telling of that story. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you remember the giddy day that Steve Case and Jerry Levin and Ted Turner danced at the merger announcement, is it too easy to say now that it was dumb? Does big innovation require big fiascos? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sad tale and saga of the AOL Time Warner dream. AOL is off the nameplate today, and the mountain of internet histories and the telling of all behind that. My guest tonight is Kara Swisher. She was Wall Street Journal's technology columnist right through so much of the boom, followed AOL from very early on in the mid-90s. She's written a new book about the forging and the meltdown of this fabulous merger that fell to pieces. It's called There Must Be a Pony in Here Somewhere, the AOL Time Warner Debacle and the Quest for the Digital Future. I'm also joined in the studio tonight by Nancy Kane, professor at Harvard Business School. She's author of Brand New, How Entrepreneurs Earned Consumers' Trust from Wedgwood to Dell. You can join this conversation. Were you a believer in AOL Time Warner, in the mega merger of our time? Are you surprised at AOL's getting chopped off the nameplate today? And what does this famously bad marriage say about the internet, about American business, about the 90s, about the future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kara Swisher, we had to cut you off, but you were about to take us into what Jared Levin was thinking.
The
mind of Jared Levin. January 10, 2000, $183 billion merger where Time Warner is really going under the hand of AOL.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I like to say about Jared Levin is he hasn't backed off from this idea. He still believes in it today. So he is the one person who has not backed off on the idea.
Can we pause right there for a moment?
Sure.
Define what is the it here that he believes in? And for that matter, it's related to, you were saying earlier that you're still a huge believer.
I am.
Are these the same things
that
you believe
in?
And what is the it of such durable belief?
That every single one of Time Warner's businesses outside of AOL is going to be deeply affected by the digital future. Their music business is in shambles at this point, as are many music businesses. The whole business plan has to be rethought because of Napster and what is happening with digital downloading. The movie business is next in line. It's 5 minutes till that's going to start happening with high-speed access. Their magazine business is less of a problem because people like to read magazines, and the internet doesn't change the magazine reading experience or the book experience, but those aren't their big divisions.
Mm-hmm.
Their cable business, as much as they're growing a lot through their high-speed access, right now wireless high-speed internet services are starting to be funded in Silicon Valley. So every one of their businesses has a digital challenge going forward. And so I think he was incredibly worried, as he should have been, about that happening. And I think he just misjudged how quickly that would happen to all his businesses.
That raises a lot of questions. But he had a history of reaching out for
big deals
to solve problems for Time Warner.
He had a history of two things: technological solutions to problems and a history of doing big deals.
That
was a good bet. You know, he paid off pretty well. That was a very defining thing for him because he believed in it, as did many others. He wasn't the only one at Time Warner that did that.
Mm-hmm.
But he believed in it, and no one else did, and he understood that. I think he did make the right bet there, and everyone laughed at him and scoffed at him, and it creates a personality when that happens. You know, these are individuals. And so when you're right against everybody else and they call you an idiot and they say you're wrong and you lose a job, you know, he lost in a little bit of a corporate war early in his career over it, and he was right, then he starts to think he's a genius. You know what I mean? He starts to think he's a visionary. So he was very interested in distribution systems and how it was going to affect content. And it was his sort of thing. And so he tried full service network, which is a huge disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Although the idea is the internet, you know, pre-internet. So it's not as if his idea was wrong. It was the execution of the idea. Then he put some money into Pathfinder, which was the big Time Warner internet site, which turned out to be just a horrible experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were doing this, companies like AOL and Yahoo and Amazon and eBay started growing and growing and growing. So it looked like Time Warner had two thumbs and nothing else and not the ability to do this, even as other people were innovating wildly.
So he was desperate.
Here's
Jerry Levin at that moment. You describe him as, this odd duck sort of severe,
right,
vaguely mystical terms around him, rabbinical, monkish, inscrutable, cryptic.
It's part of his thing.
His thing, the great lover of Albert Camus. What an odd thing. But was AOL? Well, it clearly wasn't. I mean, even if he was on to the right itch. This wasn't the way to scratch it. I mean, AOL was not the solution that he was looking for.
Yeah, but AOL was the most prominent blue chip of the Internet companies. It looked so stable, and it was, I mean, the earnings were astonishing. I mean, that's the thing. It seemed, if you had to pick among the Internet companies, because he did talk to Yahoo. I chronicle this in the book, which nobody knew about. He was in discussions with Yahoo when AOL talks broke down, mm-hmm. and AOL was in discussions to merge with eBay. And Meg Whitman was actually at the company the day they decided on the merger, and they had to move her around because they couldn't tell her anything.
Keep it under wraps.
So I mean, it wasn't as if he wasn't totally searching for this, but AOL was the most blue of the blue chips. The next one was Yahoo, and he was talking to Yahoo.
So Nancy Kane, here's a prince of American capitalism at the top of a great old fine legacy media company. He feels this change coming. He knows he has to do something. AOL is the big dog in the Internet world. And he dives for it, and it just falls apart under him. Is this how it happens? I mean, did he make a particularly bad choice? Could he have made a good choice in those circumstances? Was there a way to buy the next rung on the ladder?
It's a really good question. And if you go back to some of the other waves or the other moments when the stage of American business is rife with these mergers, I think the answer is probably yes, that he felt he had to do it. It's a big bet. Capitalism's all about bets on the future. Go back to the early railroads, right, and trying to figure out how to put these things together to make money. They know there's something here. They mm-hmm. know it connects people. They know it connects information. They know it can change the game of American business. They don't know how to make money on it. What do? They merge in big, high-stakes kind of ventures. Most of them fail. And from those mergers come the much more successful ones, the building of the Pennsylvania State Railroad, the building of United States Steel, which will come along late in those big waves of mergers. J.P. Morgan will engineer the whole thing, but not after a whole bunch of steel companies of really big stakes fail as well.
But those are railroads merging, not a railroad buying a Hindenburg manufacturer.
They're similar businesses. It's the distribution of information. They are similar.
They're
businesses.
Very similar businesses with the same kind of economies. Mm-hmm. And if you think about a different kind of business, think about, you know, National Biscuit Company, which is six kinds of different food processing companies coming together. Incidentally, that will be the biggest merger on record in the late 80s when RJR will buy it under the auspices of Henry Kravis mm-hmm. in what people said was an absolutely untenable deal. So those are businesses where you have the same kind of things governing. We've got something important here. We don't know exactly what it means. We've got a buoyant, excited capital market. We know we need some way to distribute content or in some cases to build the bridge of this new infrastructure like the railroad.
Listeners,
is that AOL, you know, was a familiar business to Levin. It had subscribers. Now, Yahoo did not, which made Levin nervous. It had advertising, which Time Warner has. Mm-hmm. It had the constant revenue streams. It was a very familiar business, and it was about information distribution, which was an obsession of Levin's.
I want to open the phones a little bit. Listeners, did you lose your shirt along with Ted Turner, and who got robbed here? Was AOL a scammer? Was Time Warner somehow a fool? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jane's calling from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad you're talking about this tonight. And I have to say, we didn't escape the debacle. We had Cisco stock. Luckily, we bought low, but we didn't sell high. but even as we bought Internet stock, and my husband worked in high-tech, my son worked for Sony Music Spinoff.com. AOL was sort of known to be the also-ran, and I'm talking through the 90s, that people in high-tech and people who were beginning to use the Internet for work all knew that AOL couldn't cut it, that AOL simply didn't have what it needed to keep going.
But Gene, I mean, they were making an awful lot of money. Were you kind of an Internet snob that you thought all the people using AOL were just troglodytes, they weren't hip?
They were making monopoly money. It
was real money initially. I mean, a lot of people in the digitality do disdain AOL. The fact of the matter is the digitality, which I'm talking about Silicon Valley, I'm talking mm-hmm. about a lot of the web creators, mm-hmm. they create these products that people, you know, AOL did one thing great, which was make an easy-to-use product and remove the technology from it and cover up the technology. No matter what you say about Steve Kazin, there's a lot of complaints you need to make against him. He did popularize the Internet for the average user.
But Jane looks at it and says it was clunky. It wasn't well put together.
So
they had blackouts.
Yeah, but most people, Microsoft is not the best software around, and gee, it has 95% of the market for various reasons. One, it does. You don't have to be the best to be the winner.
And remember QDOS, right, which began, which was the AOL of operating systems many years ago.
All I'm saying is that subscriber money was real. But, their fee money was real. Mm-hmm. Their advertising money was real. Where they had the problem is they relied too much on .com advertising money, and that was that wasn't monopoly money. That was real money when it was coming in. It just stopped coming in.
But our caller Jane is not alone in this, and it wasn't just the digitality. I mean, you write, Kara Swisher, about how AOL's stock, its reputation, went up and down wildly during the 90s.
Yeah, they often abuse consumers. Although cable companies abuse consumers, I mean, AOL does get it on the chin a lot more than my cable company. I sometimes think they should be put in jail for the kind of service they deliver. But you know, they definitely did. The one thing they did is they provided a simple, easy to use technology. And the eBays of the world, the Amazons wouldn't be here. They became easier, and that's what happened to AOL, is that everyone else became easy like AOL was. And then what do you need AOL for?
Okay, so if Time Warner was, you know, prime cut in the traditional media world, and AOL was, in your estimation, you know, top of the heap, certainly in valuation.
It was top of the heap. That's what it was. And it seemed the most stable.
How and why did this go so badly wrong?
Oh, so many things. Let's start with externals. The economy started to tank. It just simply did. The advertising market went down for everybody, anyone who had an advertising business. The internet bubble popped, finally. Finally, it popped, and that's where AOL got a lot of its advertising revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, everyone's all of a sudden started to sign up for high-speed access. That was a very slow-moving movement of mainstream consumers to that. And then all of a sudden, in 2001, everyone started to sign up for – the cable companies finally got their acts together, and AOL was not in that product selection as in the easy way they were in the dial-up market. So their subscribers started to decline. The internet got easier. Those are all external things. Internally, Jerry Levin was not in charge of his company. You know, he was the CEO, but all the different divisions were running themselves. They were, you know, it's a very famous fiefdom structure at Time Warner. And once AOL entered, the people who ran those divisions, who were supposed to cooperate with AOL at the center as the engine, said, you know, screw you. You know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to help you.
But as you describe it, AOL hardly made it attractive to be cooperative. I mean, they really came swashbuckling
in. I'm
going
to get to that. That was the worst part. So they wouldn't cooperate with. They were angry that the stock started to go down. Now, at one point, one of the executives said to me, if the stock had gone up, I would have kissed them, no matter how obnoxious they were.
But I've heard this from friends at Time, all up and down. They were just living. Well, the stock, too. I mean, they were losing money hand over fist in their 401k plans and all their investment in their own company.
I actually put that on my computer to remember that all the time. The stock went down. If the stock had stayed stable or had gone up, you know, they were happy in the first 3 months because the stock was higher than ever. AOL people were mad because it had gone down for AOL in those terms. But, you know, definitely the stock went down, and that can affect you, especially when you're risk-averse people. Like the AOL people are very cowboy culture, you know, up, down, who cares? You know, I mean, we're rich, we're poor, that kind of thing. People at Time Warner are at Time Warner because they're more stable, and they did not jump into the internet boom, and they hated themselves for that, and at the same time were unable to jump into the internet boom because of their nature. Mm. And so it was this culture crash. And then, you know, crowning glory, AOL people come in. And when you have $1 billion, for some reason you think you're a genius.
Mm-hmm.
Or even $100 million or $10 million. I mean, secretaries had $10 million. Can you imagine your secretary having $10 million and you not having any money? I mean, it's just one of these situations that's really bad. And so they came in, they started telling the movie company how to make movies, like, oh, the digital revolution's going to come and ruin your movie making business. Well, AOL's right about that, but the way they said it, like, who is this idiot? You know.
And did they really know where the bridge was that would take Time Warner to the other side of that problem? I mean, AOL had done one thing. They'd made it easy for consumers to use the web. They had hardly revolutionized movies.
No, not at all. I mean, they're right. The general idea is absolutely dead on. The digital filmmaking is going to change Hollywood in the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear it from these people at AOL who had no experience? I mean, I had a similar encounter with Jerry Yang from Yahoo, who was lecturing me about the Wall Street Journal when I was at a dinner with him. And he started lecturing me about the newspapers and the newspaper business and this and that, and this is how it's going to change. And I finally had enough of it, and I turned to him and I said, you know what? Is this your first job out of college? You know, your Yahoo job? I mean, I know you made $8 billion, but you know what? Shut up. I've been working, you know, I mean,
you, my friend, are not God. Dan's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Great.
The lady talking there, she has so many good points and so many good insights in that. But what I'm noticing here is that there's a real negative slant to the thinking going on here. that everything that's happened and is still happening is somehow negative and comically ill-conceived and that type of thing. I just don't see it that way at all.
Well, the merger doesn't seem to have worked out real well, but how do you see it, Dan?
They're still merged.
Yeah, they are
still
merged.
They just changed their names, that's all.
Dan, let me say, in the book, I actually talk about being a huge believer in the internet space.
Well,
I think the idea is absolutely dead on. I think they just executed it badly.
I think you're presenting a positive and a negative side of things, but somehow it always ends up at the end of the discussion coming out to the negative, thing. I think Levin may still be vindicated, and that
I think
he's
he will
working
be.
It. He's still working it.
I know he's actually living in Marina Del Rey with a new partner, a new person he's with. He left his wife, but I think you're absolutely right. I think his general idea is correct that every single aspect of our society is going to be transformed by the internet. And just what happened was during the late 90s, it became a stock story, and it was not about the transformative effects of the internet. Right now, weblogs, personals on the internet, the way people reach out to each other. There's so much excitement. I mean, email alone is amazing. Just imagine your life without email, and you didn't have it 5 years ago.
But Kara, to Dan's point, let's pick that up. The path to Levin's vindication here.
Mm-hmm.
What would that be? I mean, just because the internet will ultimately change everything, and you'll have every mobile remote piece of equipment on your body will be tied into everything else in the world. And presumably that's still coming. But does that mean, because he foresaw that or feared it or whatever it was, does that mean it was a good idea to merge in business terms with AOL?
No, I don't think it was because of the way they executed it, first of all, and because of the timing. I mean, the man lost, not him alone, but $100 billion in value was lost. So someone's going to be angry about that. I didn't own the stock, but if you had this in your 401k, people are justifiably angry by what happened, and they don't want to hear about the greater issue. And I think they're absolutely right to be angry in the short term, and they don't want to know about the long term, and that it may be good for Time Warner, it may be this or it may be that, because what they're left with right now is a very wounded AOL and a very angry corporation that doesn't want to that is a little bit more reticent to enter more digital things because they've been burned so many times.
What are the wounds you see on AOL now?
Well, within Time Warner, it's amazing how badly they're going to be doing because you can't – right now, for example, Yahoo stock, it went through a really low period. I think it was like $8 a share. I'm just talking about Wall Street shares. But now it's up in the $40 range. Amazon has recovered and its stock has recovered. eBay has taken on the world and its stock is in huge numbers now. AOL, within Time Warner, even though it makes more money than all these companies combined, is valued at negative numbers. Okay? It makes more profit and has more subscribers and has presumably more power, but it's valued at absolutely nothing. And that's a really interesting thing. So but inside Time and Warner, they cannot do the innovative things they need to do to move to the next thing. They can't do acquisitions. They can't push themselves. They've got people above them always watching them. They've got people angry at them constantly. So within Time Warner, they're sort of withering.
Doesn't look good. Kara Swisher, stand by. Kara Swisher, author of the new book, There Must Be a Pony in Here Somewhere, with Nancy Kane as well tonight from the Harvard Business School. You can join the conversation. Is it too easy to say now that it was all dumb? Does big innovation require big fiascos? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the saga of the AOL Time Warner dream. AOL is off the nameplate as of today. It's just Time Warner again. There's a mountain of internet history in the telling of that story. A lot to learn, a lot to look back on, a lot to look forward on. My guest tonight is Kara Swisher. She's author of There Must Be a Pony in Here Somewhere, the AOL Time Warner debacle and the quest for the digital future. Kara Swisher was technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal right through those boom years of the 90s. She covered AOL for a long time. She was in the middle of the meltdown, watching it from a front row seat. She says she's still a believer in the internet, but my, what a story she's seen along the way. We're also joined tonight by Nancy Kane, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. You can join the conversation as well. Is it too easy to say now that it was all dumb? Who got robbed here? Was AOL a scammer? Was Time Warner a fool? Was this all just the expensive birth pangs of a new technology era? And did it have to be so expensive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kara Swisher, give us some more of the personalities here. Of course,
Ted Turner. That's all you have to say to me.
Wow. I mean, what a big outsized one. He can dance and he can swear and he's got some.
He likes to swear.
Woo! His response to all this is over the top, as you can only imagine. But he always tells you he was robbed.
He does. He was really, he's the perfect, to me, he's the symbol of the whole merger and it's all its confusion and its all the different hypocriticalness of it, a whole bunch of things. He was incredibly enthusiastic about the merger when it began. And if you remember at that press conference, he said, you know, this is more exciting than the first night I made love some 40-some years ago. I mean, come on. That was an amazing statement. Like, oh, we actually thought about trying to find the woman he first made love to. So,
how was it for you, that merger?
Yeah, exactly. Like, gosh, you know. And so he was very enthusiastic, and then he started to turn on it when the stock went down, you know, because he's got well-known mood swings. And so he started to turn on Levin, who he had long hated, and then he loved, and he never really loved him, but he was constantly at war with Levin and then not at war. So he turned on it and then turned on Levin and joined with Steve Case, and then he turned on Steve Case, and then he bemoaned that he was robbed, and then this and that and this and that. And then relatively recently, he stepped down as vice chairman when he didn't get picked to be chairman of the board, you know, God forbid.
And how much did Ted Turner lose in all this?
I think $7 or $8 billion. Except the week he sold a bunch of stock, a lot of his stock, and then 3 weeks later he had lost $200 million in doing that transaction as early as he did. You know, so he was constantly sort of messing, like going back and forth and back and forth, and it sort of was the same kind of thing at Time Warner. He was the perfect, you know, emotional gauge that you could gauge what was going on here.
Ted Turner, an unhappy camper right there. Bob's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I wonder if you could talk about the cultures of the two companies and how that might have affected the merger. I'm thinking when you look at the press conference, you see the people from Time Warner, the suits and the ties, and then you see Steve Case with the, you know, the open shirt, the sport
khakis,
coat, the young versus old, the innovative versus whatever.
You describe it as the Nazis invading Paris or some Time person describing it.
You know, it's so interesting. The Time Warner people are known to be some of the most vicious corporate infighters of all time, and they kept saying how much they were victims. And they kept saying, oh, we're such victims. I'm like, well, why are all the AOL people dead? You know, it was interesting. They are actually, that press conference, Gerald Levin wore the khakis and the T-shirt or the jean shirt. And
at
Steve
the merger
Case wore
announcement,
the suit.
Right. Yeah, reversal of the uniforms.
It was a little ridiculous. But, you know, OK, it was a visual. So they definitely the AOL was aggressive. We know it all. The Internet's changing the world. We're changing the world. We're billionaires. So you must listen to us. Kind of attitude and see, and one of that was born from being mocked for so long. You know, now we're winners. See, we're going to show you we were right. You know, and the Time Warner people, there's an expression I love from AOL where they, I'm not going to use the dirty one, but there was an expression where they thought Time Warner people were deny, delay, and retire. So these were people that were very much recalcitrant and wouldn't help, wouldn't be part of change unless they were doing the change. Very fiefdoms, very vicious corporate infighters, very political. Did a lot of leaks to the press, which was incredibly damaging to the merger, especially to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Very used to keeping, you know, balance of power, sort of like European states. This just did not work. When AOL tried to impose a central control on them, that was sort of the end of AOL's lifetime at that corporation.
Two continents crashing into one another there. Terry's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering what Time Warner was thinking AOL was bringing to the table besides just this big name, and couldn't they come up with a technology, maybe start a little smaller but accomplish some of the same goals possibly?
Terry, thanks for the call. Kara Swisher.
Well, they had tried and tried and tried and lost and lost and lost. It was really kind of pathetic. Every single one of their efforts was just a mess. So Levin thought they needed to inject Internet DNA, and who better to be the Internet DNA than the most prominent Internet company?
Was there a way it could have worked in that case?
It was supposed to be the center. It was called the crown jewel, actually, of the company. It was going to be around which everything else, you know, the record company would do a digital downloading deal with AOL. The movie company would do a digital downloading deal. They would advertise. They would cross-advertise. advertise on each other. You know, the AOL service would run a would email its users about movies and stuff like that. There would be chats. The magazines would go on AOL and vice versa. They'd put AOL name in the magazines. The big thing in the center of it was the cable deal, and that was Steve Case's big move, and I think he was correct in that, attempting that at least, which was that AOL, instead of Roadrunner, which was their service, which was the only successful thing they ever actually did in the digital space.
At Time Warner.
They were going to put AOL instead of Roadrunner, and then AOL would be sold in Time Warner households, you know, across the nation as the way you got onto the internet in high speed. So that was a great thing for AOL.
But Kara, you've looked at this. Do you think it could have worked? Was it just poorly executed, or was this just a meeting? You know, were there antibodies here that were not going to work out?
If Gerald Levin had control of those divisions, it could have. He could have imposed that. He could have said, cable company, you will be now AOL cable company. You know what I mean? And AOL will be the service you sell, and that's the only service you
sell. But is change that easy? I mean, so much about the Internet was just ahead of the moment when it could actually be pulled off. Nancy King, let me put this to you. I mean, we put the question out there about whether big innovation requires big fiascos.
See, I think the answer to that question is unfortunately yes, at a systems level. And I'm not sure that this merger wasn't, regardless of how it was executed, and I think Kara makes tremendously important points, too early on the stage. I mean, there were just too many things to happen that got in the way, from broadband becoming popular to what happened to the stock market to the speed with which the digital revolution took hold. None of that was on the table in 1999 when Case first started talking to Levin. So if the system works by pushback learning like an ecosystem, the economy, mm-hmm. American business, then great debacles are a kind of first principle or necessary condition of great innovation.
And Kara Swisher, you quote Marshall McLuhan from the mm-hmm. 1960s. Of course, different technology, but he said, innumerable confusions and a profound feeling of despair invariably emerge in periods of great technological and cultural transition. Does that make this inevitable?
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite quotes when I used to cover retail, Sam Walton, it was from Sam Walton, and someone asked him what his greatest business advice is, and he said, the planes are covered with the bodies of pioneers, which I love that expression. And, you know, that's great if you're living in California now or reaping the California benefits when we were making that move across the country. But it's not so great if you were a pioneer, you know, because you had an arrow on your back.
Probably wasn't so great for the ponies either.
No, but, you know, it's great for this country. That's right. I think you definitely need that kind of thing to happen. And it's happened every time. It's like the compute right before the Internet revolution, there was the chip revolution, and a lot of chip companies were wiped out. Before that was the PC revolution. And from the PC revolution, Microsoft finally emerged. But there were hundreds of companies like Microsoft.
So a pony will come, has come out of all this, but watch your step as you go.
No, there'll be another disaster. There'll be another disaster along the way.
Disasters, but growth at the same time.
You know, one of the things, people think of technology as only something that beeps and has electronics in it, but technology is everything. The axe in the American life was a technology, and it's a good thing because it took the prairie and made it into developed, and it also took the prairie. So,
Kara Swisher, we've got to let you go, but what a wonderful book. Thanks for writing it.
Thanks for
being with us tonight. Kara Swisher, author of the new book, There Must Be a Pony in Here Somewhere, The AOL Time Warner Debacle and the Quest for the Digital Future. And Nancy Kane, thanks so much for your perspective tonight. Just great having you.
Pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums in a moment. Senator Edward Kennedy blasts the $87 billion Iraqi aid plan. This is On Point. As the House prepares to approve President Bush's request for $87 billion for the reconstruction of Iraq and Afghanistan, the request is hitting opposition in the Senate. A bipartisan group of senators want to convert $10 billion of the dollars earmarked as aid to Iraq into a loan, unless the Bush administration convinces other countries to forgive Iraq's debts. If the loan provision passes, it will be a major rebuff to the administration, which has been lobbying hard against it. Meanwhile, in both houses of Congress, critics of the war and its aftermath have been stepping up their rhetoric against the president. Last week, On Point brought you National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice's address to the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, her part of the administration's effort to boost support for the U.S. effort in Iraq. Tonight, we bring you excerpts of Senator Edward Kennedy's sharp criticism of the administration's handling of the war from the Senate floor earlier today.
The administration's policy of rushing to put multi-billion-dollar contracts in the hands of America's firms ignores not only the lesson of history, but also the lesson of human nature. The Iraqi people need to be the real partners in the reconstruction effort. The administration is wrongly working from the top down rather than from the bottom up to rebuild Iraq. A new Iraq will emerge neighborhood by neighborhood, town by town, province by province. We need the closer alignment between the military units working on reconstruction and the civilians working at the Coalition Provisional Authority. We can't solve every problem from Saddam's palaces in Baghdad. Why not scale back the lavish resources being provided to U.S. contractors and consultants and provide larger sums and assistance directly to the Iraqi people? We could do so in many cases by developing ties between local councils and the Iraqi Governing Council. We could work more with local non-governmental organizations and local businesses. In all cases, we need to insist on transparency in the process so we know where the funding is going. It is the Iraqi people's country. They have the greatest stake in the success of the reconstruction, and involving them now will enhance the prospects for success. In some areas of Iraq, we've already been able to achieve impressive results with small amounts of money. In one case, we funded the building of a cement factory for less than $100,000 when the bid by an American contractor for the same project was in the millions. Why not do more on this with schools and medical clinics, roads, and countless other projects? Iraqi has many of the best-trained petroleum engineers in the world. Why not give them, rather than the American companies, a larger role in rebuilding the industry? Why not create jobs for Iraqis and give them ownership of their own reconstruction? If we insist on saying Halliburton rules because to the victor belongs the spoils, we won't be the victor for very long. In their joint memoir, A World Transformed, President George H.W. Bush and his National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, reflected on their own experiences with Iraq and the Gulf War in 1991. They had been criticized in some quarters for halting that war after their dramatic victory in Kuwait instead of going on to Baghdad to depose Saddam Hussein. Here is what they wrote. Trying to eliminate Saddam, extending the ground war into an occupation of Iraq, would have violated our guideline again about not changing objectives in midstream, engaging in mission creep, and would have incurred incalculable human and political costs. Apprehending him was probably impossible. We would have been forced to occupy Baghdad and, in effect, rule Iraq. The coalition would instantly collapse, the Arabs deserting it in anger and other allies pulling out as well. Under those circumstances, there was no viable exit strategy we could see. Had we gone the invasion route, the United States conceivably still be an occupying power in a bitterly hostile land. It would have been a dramatically different and perhaps barren outcome. It's time for this administration to admit that it was wrong and turn in a new direction. We need a genuine plan that acknowledges the realities on the ground. We need a plan that gives real authority to the United Nations so that other nations truly will share the burden. We need to actively engage the Iraqi people in governing and rebuilding their country. Our soldiers now risking their lives in Iraq deserve no less. And here at home, all Americans are being asked to bear the burden, too. And they deserve more than a phony summons to support our troops by supporting policies that will only condemn them to greater and greater danger. Yes, we must stay the course, but not the wrong course.
Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy speaking earlier today on the floor of the U.S. Senate. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.